in this book, black people ain't heroes either. You know, we can be harmful too. We can, the black church ain't no heroic story. It is a beautiful story and a terrible story as well.
No, we're not gonna start shouting on this interview.
Hey, I'm a preacher now. Hey, I'll take you to the text now. I will take you to the text. I'll take you to the threshing floor, to the temple. We'll go to the throne room.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest, whom you just heard me laughing with, is Dante Stewart, author of the memoir Shouting in the Fire, an American Epistle. A bona fide church boy, Dante discusses what it means to grow up black and Christian and yet still cling to whiteness.
We look at the ways white people think and preach and write as divine. We see white religion as pure, but we see black religion as problematic. And this is not just simply upheld by white people. Many of us black people, and I'm thinking particularly about black men in Christian spaces, we do the work of white supremacy for them.
In his memoir, Dante takes the reader on a journey about how he became deluded by white supremacy. The four words that led to his reckoning and reawakening in the face of so many dead black bodies, and why he holds black literature sacred, even though he didn't really begin reading books completely until 2017. You heard that right. Dante tells his story when Black and Published continues.
When did you know that you were a writer?
I think, no lie, you know, like I always, even as a kid, like I always loved poetry. Like my mama, she always has this joke, like, who would have thought you would have been like this? So I went through a phase as a kid where I loved art. I loved poetry. I wrote a little poetry collection in college, and my mama still get on me to this day that I don't have that poetry collection. And I gave it to one of the professors. So yeah, it probably when I was a kid, like I knew I loved like words and language and things like that. And I was a little preaching kid. So I always like words and things. And like in college, like I never really read like that. I didn't finish my first book, like reading as a reader. I did not finish my first book until like 2017, bro. And so like, yeah.
I'm not gonna judge you.
Okay, don't judge me.
I'm not gonna judge you.
Until like 2017. But then like, that's when I really, like when I really started like going through what I was going through, I always keep a journal. This is like my ninth journal over the years, just chronicling my life and things I'm feeling and things like that. So I would say I really knew I was a writer. It had to be maybe like in 2019 when I wrote, self-published my own devotional. And then like we threw it out and then people loved it. Like, you know, I was writing essays and stuff like since like 2016. But then when I released that, that's kind of when I was like, yeah, I'm like legit like a writer.
So you started writing as a child. But it didn't really hit you until just a few years ago. You played college football. Mm-hmm. You play instruments. You mm-hmm. went to a seminary at a diverse church. We'll get to that. Mm-hmm. And then I think in the reckoning that happened in 2016 with all of the death of Black men and women, is that when you started to begin journaling your thoughts before you started to like really go toward it?
Yeah. So like, I would say I probably started journaling in like 2014 when I was in Cali. But then like during that moment, and was interesting, it was not a diverse church. It was a white church, exclusively white, that tried to say it was diverse and trying to become diverse. But it was a extremely white church. But during that moment, like really, that's when I really started like wrestling with deeper questions of, you know, what it meant to be Black and Christian, and, you know, really thinking about the country and trying to wrestle with like what was going on around me, whether that be through the death of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, and then even the responses of people. And so like, I'll never forget, like when I wrote in my journal, and there was a section in the book where like I wrote those four words, you know, and like it was during that moment where I wrote those four words, and I go back to my journal. I'm like, dang, this is what I really going through, like what I was feeling during that moment and things like that. And that's really when I started like wrestling deeply with the question about like, yo, I need to find some answers. I need to find out like, what does this mean? And what do I feel? And in some sense, like when I look back on it, like that process was about a lot of failure too. Like it was a lot of failure in that moment. Like what I wrote and what I thought, I went back. And sometimes I tell my wife all the time, like, I'd be like, dang, like, who was I? Like, what did I become? Like, it was so crazy. I was like, oh my goodness. Like, who is this person? And so, yeah, like during that moment in white churches and beyond was really when I started like wrestling and reading was really what kind of turned me on to like, my journaling went way different. Like I started like analyzing like what I was reading and I started writing about it and thinking and really wrestling with it. And so, yeah, that was that moment where I really started journaling. I think like a lot of my thoughts as a writer and even like my social media platform was generated kind of in that solitary space when I was just with myself, my thoughts, my feeling, my trauma, the text that I was reading, the Bible, my prayers, what other people were saying about me and revealing of myself. And that really, really hard process of like really staring yourself in the mirror and realizing that, yo, like there are some things that really need to change and I don't have no answers. I don't know if I can generate those answers, but I really need to wrestle with it.
It's so funny that you say this. Up until this year, I went to a diverse church. It wasn't until this year where I was like, you know what? After the George Floyd and the 2020 election and just a lot of different messages and COVID, I was like, I can't do y'all no more. So I've been in a space where I'm like, all right, I want to go back to church. And I've been flirting with different churches and different preachers and just trying to get the word any way I can. So reading your book, it really spoke to me. But you have a spot where you say on page 214, writing had become a place of sanctuary, a place of following Jesus into the wilderness when I felt overwhelmed. It had become a church. How did that, I guess, that journey in the wilderness for you get you to a point where you said, I want to put this into a written and published text and give it to the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it really took a lot of courage, no lie, because in some sense, like that's the hard part about like writing is, I mean, you giving away so much of like the secret places to give people those secret places, like those things like you're wrestling with and thinking through. I mean, it's a very courageous process. And it really took a lot of prayer. If I'm being honest, like it took a lot of prayer and a lot of therapy. And most of all, it took my wife just like really like being there for me in ways that like helped me wade it through like memories and clarify so much. Cause I, in all honesty, I put my wife through things that was like not necessary, that was harmful and hurtful. And I felt like to write something like this, I needed her help to help me understand my own self. And I couldn't like put this on page if I didn't realize like this story is mine. I'm not the hero of the story, but I'm just the one who tells it. And so like putting it all together really took a whole team and a lot of my writer friends who encouraged me to keep on going. Cause like there were moments there. And I particularly think about the chapter entitled Womb. Like that was the chapter where I wanted to kind of give up. Like that was the chapter where I was just like, you know, I don't know if I can make it through this. Like it was just kind of beating me up so much emotionally that I was afraid to write it. And then that was the chapter that really made me like, yo, I really need to go to therapy. And so therapy helped me kind of get through it. And my team, my wife. And then also I knew that it was a book I needed to write. We hear this Toni Morrison phrase and we use it all the time where we say like, yo, if there is a book that you want to read and it's not been written yet, you got to write it.
Right.
And I feel like we use that a lot, but like, it's legit. Like it's for real. Like this was a book that I felt like hasn't been written yet in the way that I wrote it. You know, I ain't trying to boost, but like legit, like I felt like there was a uniqueness about the style of writing, like a book by a Black Christian writer centered in the genre of memoir.
So then in saying that, because it is unique in that there's no doubt that you are Black and Christian, but it's heavy on the Black with a sprinkle of the Christian. Like I see the scriptures there, but it's heavily grounded in your story and your life story. But then you just caught me because, like, on page 220, you say how much I have lied as a writer. So I'm like, well, is the book not honest? Like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's real. Hey, thank you for noticing that. And I think there are parts of, like, writing where, like when we think about, like, lying and things, it's kind of this where people will feel Kiese's book heavy, where, like, you know, he begins, I wanted to write a lie. 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 You know, and I felt that, like that is a part of it. Like, there were parts of my book where, like, as a writer, there were parts in my life as a person where I lied about the way I felt. I lied about I was better than I was actually doing. I lied that, like, you know, like, certain things were certain ways and I was okay with it. Or in some sense, like, you know, I lied in ways that would, like, get me places. Like in some sense, like, it was very transactional. When you go through college and like you're so immersed in, like, yo, you're the exception, you're exceptional, or you feel like you gotta prove. And, like, I write about my boy, like, distrust, and on the football field and things like that, like, so much of that proving of, like, your own self-worth and your own self-respect. And even the way to deal with trauma and pain, a lot of times, you know, we lie, you know, to kind of, you know, make ourselves feel better than we are. But also we lie to kind of protect ourselves. So, like, I think there is a part of, like, writing early on where, like, for me, life was this, especially Blackness and Black life. Like, I felt like it was built on a lie of, like, this kind of triumphal writing of Blackness that I did. Like, the Black church always did this. Black people always did this. Mm-hmm. And so it only represented, like, part of the story. And I felt like I needed to kind of rip that apart as a writer in my own self to dislodge myself from these triumphal stories of myself as a person, but also the place that I'm fundamentally tied to. The Black church, Black religion, Black Christianity, Christianity in general.
Yes.
Like, I needed to write in such a way that people would say, like, I may not agree with that or whatever, but, like, at least he told the truth. Like, at least he told the truth. And I think, you know, as the Bible say, you know, as Jesus said, you know, the truth shall make you free. And I think a part of that freedom that I found beyond the lying is that, like, I needed to write in such a way, and I needed to live in such a way where I'm not the hero of the story. I'm just the one who writes it. I'm the one who tells it. And you do whatever you want with that. And I needed to do whatever I needed with that so that when other people get it, somehow it would make them a little bit more honest, a little bit more loving, a little bit more tender, a little bit more patient, and much better in our faith, in our life, in our own selves, mm-hmm. than many of the ways we learn how to be.
Very much so. You said it a couple of times that you are not the hero of the story. And I think that's refreshing that you say that, because in a way, in reading the book and in reading your story and how you have come to this revelation to even put this book down, you've put yourself on trial. Yourself, your beliefs, your thought processes, as harmful as they could have been, to as evolved as they have gotten, on trial. Then you put the church on trial, and then you put America itself on trial, and then try to really examine where it is that you can fit as a Black Christian American in this society that doesn't see value in Black life and Black bodies. It's really heavy on, like, trying to get free. And that's something that's always, you know, preached in church. You know, you're trying to get free. And freedom is through Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But Jesus has been used to oppress. So in indicting yourself and indicting your own beliefs and putting that on paper, how did you get through it? Like, saying, this is the worst of me in these thoughts and these beliefs, and I'm trying to get better. How did you wrestle with that?
I mean, if I have to put words to it, it's really like, you know, because nobody ever asked me that before, you know? And so, like, I thank you for that question. I'm even thinking now, like, you know, how did I get through that? I think a part of it was showing up every day,
mm-hmm.
to write, even when I was afraid. There were so many moments in this book where, like, I was like, should I write that? Like, should I include that? Whatnot? Should I talk about it? But I had to be honest. Like, and I just credit so much to KSA, like, to Heavy. Like, there was a section in Heavy that changed me as a writer. It literally changed me. And it changed the way I wrote my book. It's the section in Seatbelts where he talks about his daddy. And his daddy showing up. And he's like, he has this line, like, more than I needed a present father, my mother needed a loving partner. And like that whole section, like after I read that joint, like I put it down and like I started writing in my journal again. And like I'm in tears because I realized that that was me. Like I was not loving. And it made me think about like, dang, well, how many times did I in my life like love things and being around certain people more than I love my wife? Like, how much did I do that and not love myself? How much did I do that and not love other people? And how do I wrestle with that? And so, like, really, the courage really came through voices, like came through the books I was reading. And I'm like, yo, I gotta write something that's honest. I really believe that like literacy and liberation go hand in hand. Mm. You know, reading does not just, you know, give us a bunch of knowledge, but it gives us ways to understand the world and interpret the world. And it gives us ways to think about our own experiences. So when I read Baldwin and I read The Fire Next Time, and he talks to his nephew and was like, yo, here you were to be loved, baby, hard at once, forever to strengthen you against a loveless world. And then he goes on to say, like, yo, like, if we had not loved one another, none of us would survive. Mm. And then he goes in the back end of that joint and he asks this one question almost at the end of the book that so many people miss. He looks around at the world. He says, what will happen to all this beauty? And I think about like my life, love, writing, language, lies, failure, the worlds that exist between me and my grandma and my granddaddy, and what kind of world can be generated from this? And how do I need to tell that story? How do I need to tell the story about me and my wife? How do I need to tell that story about me and my teammates and me and white people and me and myself? If I did not find a way to love and write something loving, which meant that I had to write as honestly as I possibly could, then the beauty of what this meant would be lost. What would happen with all that beauty? It would be lost. Mm. And so that's how I got through. I just kept thinking about like the beauty of being human, the beauty of my broken faith, the beauty of faith is finding home again. Mm. The beauty of picking up the pieces when they're broken. The beauty of finding worlds in wounds. I didn't want to lose the beauty. And I knew other people as well didn't want to lose that beauty as well. So I had a responsibility as a writer to do that.
So in your responsibility as a writer to never lose the beauty is one thing. But then you took that responsibility and you entrusted it to be published in a book by a publishing company. So what was that process like of you saying, you know, I want to share this with the world and I need to go about it in a way that gives it the biggest reach possible?
Mm. That was really through my relationships, for real though. And that's one of the things I tell like people in general, but like writers in particular, like, You gotta have people who have been where you want to go, who can help you get a little bit closer to where you want to be. Mm. And so for me, it was about those relationships, those relationships with people, you know, like Deisha and Kiese and Robert and Jason and Mateo and Maurice, and just, you know, all these writers who were like pouring into me. It was through those relationships that made me really believe that I had something to say. Mm. Relationships for me have meant more in a sense of, you know, you never know what can happen in a relationship or whatnot. But also, we need really good friends because you never know what you can do together. Mm. And I think when I thought about, you know, putting this in like publishing this work, you know, it wasn't because somebody told me like, yo, you can't write, you can't be this, you can't be that. And I had to prove them wrong. Nah, it was because people told me that I could, and I believed them, and I kept believing them, and I kept believing them, and I kept believing them, and I kept writing, and I kept going until boom, and it actually came to fruition. So much of that was built on relationship, but I'm that type of person that believe like where many of us are today is because other people stood in the gap for us, whether that be through, you know, them working behind the scenes to represent us, to say our name to people, to connect us with people, or they were praying for us. So I'm sure that where I am right now is because some prayer that some mother or deacon or my grandma or one of the pastors I grew up with prayed that came to fruition over these last few years. And I truly believe that. I believe that as well. It took hard work and it took some connection, but also I do believe that, you know, a lot of this is also answer prayers that other people pray.
Talk about people intercessing on your behalf.
Oh, yeah. And you know, as much as we read The Fire Next Time as like a great, beautiful piece of literature, you know, as I said earlier, that first essay that Baldwin wrote, I think there could be something generated for us in our own thinking of reading that part, you know, My Dungeon Shook, as a prayer. Like there is a sort of like sacredness between Baldwin and his nephew. And even in my book, there is intercession. There is a sort of sacredness of leaning on the voices of the ancestors. So I call on the ancestors' name. You know, there's a meme going around, you know, you need to teach your children about African spirituality very young so that when they get older, they don't think it's demonic. You know, and I believe that we need to, because in the Hebrew Bible, they calling on the ancestors. They calling on the ancestors' name, you know, to say that I'm living in light of the spirit of this person. And I believe that that so much of my book is in the spirit of Baldwin and in the spirit of Bambara and in the spirit of Katie Cannon and James Cone and the record that they left for us. These are the things of life that we use in our own literature so that we become their answer prayers in our moment and can transfer to our children and to our friends and to young kids in school right now and to people on the street, prayers that can be answered in their own moment, in their own way. So shoot, I believe like I do believe my book is a prayer. It's a prayer too and a sermon. Whatnot. So yeah.
No, I noticed that, but I feel like what I think I noticed the most about Black folks specifically is that even if we don't say that we're religious, even if we don't call ourselves Christian, there is always that deep knowing that prayer answers and that God is there and that we just have to call out. So do you have your book or the manuscript where you can read some of it for the audience?
Yeah. I do.
Black and Published family, it is time for the reading. Shouting in the Fire, An American Epistle, is as much memoir as it is religious tome. A reckoning with the white supremacy couched in the belief of white Jesus and how God-fearing Black folk can ultimately get free.
Matter of fact, let's go to 112, and I start there, and I read a little bit down from 112. We'll start at 1 year later. So 1 year later, the man who murdered Philando Castile was acquitted of second-degree manslaughter and intentional discharge of a firearm. It's hard to describe the way my body stung. I was already enraged, already knowing deep in my bones the terror that could be visited upon my body. I think for the first time in my life, I really felt the bone-chilling loss of faith in this country and in this Christianity that criminalized our dead. I felt what it must have felt like for those who had seen Jesus. The pain, the deep sadness as you saw someone whom you love be snatched from you. He too was murdered publicly. His family and his friends watch his cries, his weeping, the blood flowing from his flesh as he loved those who would not love. I felt what it was like to lose faith, faith in yourself, faith in others, faith in a country to love you back, faith in the right things being done. I needed words and I found them. I needed some way to talk about what I was feeling and I found them and they found me. I sat in my study, having just finished dinner with Jazz, the smell of curry chicken still on my breath and my clothes. I pulled out my small brown journal, turned a page that had been written on before. July 22nd, 2017. I wrote four words. Tears, anger, confusion, scared. That was where I was. I did not feel hope, faith. I didn't feel all things would be made new. This story was too familiar. Nothing was new about it. It was very old. I had gotten used to hearing stories of people being set free in ways we only could have imagined. So I started to write. I felt that I had to eulogize and honor once again a dead Black body. In desperation and sadness, trying to find some words of faith in the face of Black death, I started reading James Cone. I read The Cross and the Lynching Tree, The Spirituals and the Blues, and Black Theology and Black Power. I read J.D. Otis Roberts' Liberation and Reconciliation. I read Stacey Floyd Thomas' Deepest Shades of Purple. I read Black theologians. I read Black historians. I read Black poetry. I listened to Black songs. I looked at Black art. I couldn't find a way out of the dark struggle except reading Black theology alongside Limitations and the Story of Jesus in the Mess of Life. It was not so much that Cone had all the answers, but for the first time, I was reading a theologian who looked like me, felt like me, talked like me, loved Jesus like me, who knew the comfort of being around white folk like me, who knew the failures of white folk like me, and who knew he had to leave like me.
Thank you. So before that section, you have written on page 71 that white supremacy was still our greatest sin and our deepest delusion. And you go on to talk about how not only is it a delusion, but is it a delusion that you then fell into and you began to believe all the things that were wrong or bad or ill-informed about Black culture in the name of getting closer to whiteness, and that, you know, in the face of Black death, you had to re-examine those beliefs for within yourself. Mm-hmm. Why do you think in this reckoning and in your own reawakening of what it means to be Black and Christian, that you never lost faith in God, even though you were struggling with how God has been used?
In a sense, I did lose faith. Mm. Like, I lost faith in so much of the ways I thought about God, thought about Christianity, thought about Black people. So like, I had to lose that to pick it up again, to find it again. So it's almost like I'm reminded of the story of Moses going into, you know, in Hebrew Bible, going into Midian. And he says, you know, my name is Gershom, for I'm a stranger in a foreign land. And then in Exodus chapter 3, he meets God at the burning bush. But years have passed, and it just so happened that one day he shows up at a bush and God speaks to him. And so I think about my story like that, like Moses had to leave what was familiar. And so for me, I did give up faith. I did deconstruct so much and dismantle so much of the racist and sexist and homophobic ways of thinking about Christianity. And I had to take on a better faith story, because I knew that if I was going to exist in this world and be in public as a Christian and really take seriously the message of Jesus when it comes to embodying a faith in a way of liberation and love, then I had to find new ways of being Christian and being human and being American. And so, yes, I lost it. But then it found me again. Okay. And I will probably put it that way, that the ways of thinking about my faith and finding it and living in it and embodying it, it found me on my journey as the burning bush showed up in Moses' journey. I mean, it found me in the ways that when I went back home and I saw, like, you know, I saw my people and saw them with fresh eyes and saw my Pentecostal upbringing and was able to make sense of it. It found me in ways when I was by myself reading Black literature. I've read Baldwin in that section of The Fire Next Town where he says, you know, if our conception of God cannot make us larger and more loving, then it's about time we get rid of him. Mm. And the freedom to say there are some things that you need to get rid of. And as those in the Bible would read the stories of other people, for that's what the Bible is, before it's ever a collection of instructions or rules, it is a book of stories to help us make sense and meaning. And so just as I, as a Christian, found deep meaning in the Bible in its sacredness and its holiness to help me function in the world and think about the world, I read Black literature like that. So when Morrison in Paradise, when they preach this sermon, and, you know, and it's like, you know, your humanity didn't have to be proved. You only had to accept it. Or in Beloved, when she would say, here in this place, we flesh, flesh that weeps and dances in the grass. Flesh, you must love it, for that is the prize. Faith found me in that. Like the faith that Jesus, when Jesus said, you know, the Spirit of the Lord has come upon me. Mm-hmm. To preach good news. When I made sense of my story, that was good news. When I realized that these moments in my life, could, you know, that the stories that other people told about me was not just simply the final story, but I had the ability to pick up the pen again and rewrite it and retell it. That was faith finding me again. And I think for me as a writer, why haven't I given up? It's because I do feel like, you know, that God has anointed me, you know, as a writer, as a preacher, as a minister, as a human, as a husband, as a father, as a friend, to help people not be left behind, to help people make sense of it, to be as honest as I possibly can, to say, like, this story, being a Christian, it's not pure. It's full of problems. And we need to be honest about that. We need to make sense of our history and the stories that we inherit. And we need to, if that is so within our desire, we need to help people tell a better story. For that's what Jesus did. You know, as Toni Morrison would say in The Sight of Memory, she says, memory, that the act of imagination is bound up in memory. And that we must imagine, that we must ponder the actual and imagine the possible. And I think for me, I haven't given up because I still believe that my job as a writer, as a person, as a minister, is to keep on pondering, keep on probing, keep on reading, keep on thinking, keep on praying, keep on living, keep pondering the actual so that I can help my family, my friends, this world, my faith, imagine what other possibilities can be had in this world for us and in the world to come.
You talk about, you know, divorcing yourself from the familiarity of white supremacy and being in white spaces and learning to navigate in that, which was extremely vulnerable to really say that you were exploring your own self-hatred to dismantle it and the delusions of what the proximity of whiteness does to a Black body and a Black mind and a Black spirit. And we all in this world know what it means to delude ourselves to be able to just survive in white supremacy. But what we're trying to find is Black liberation. So what is the role of Christianity in Black liberation?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I think for me, it's characterized in one simple statement, you know, that I always say all of the time. And I just want to hone this in, that the message should be, Black people should not have to be extraordinary, superhuman, in performance or in pain, or dead, to be cherished, loved, protected, and free. We deserve joy and liberation simply because we are human. And I think that's the way, you know, that Christianity helps in Black liberation or aids in Black liberation. It allows our stories to be sacred and holy. And you can read our stories just as the people in the Bible read other people's stories. You can read it as sacred texts. I read Black literature as sacred texts. I read Black stories as sacred stories. I read Black histories as sacred histories. There's something of God being in that story. There's something of beauty and love and meaning to be generated out of that story. But also, I think it should allow us to embrace the fullness of our Black humanity. So as a black writer, as a Black preacher, as a Black minister, I feel there's a responsibility, especially being heterosexual, being married, being young. I feel that whatever are those privileges of being heterosexual and Black and male, I need to figure out who is not being seen, who is not being heard regarding Black women, regarding Black LGBTQ, regarding Black poor folk, regarding Black rural stories, who is not being heard. And me as a Black thinker and theologian, you know, to make sure that I responsibly and lovingly embrace those stories and weave it within my own thinking so that I stand in the world with other Black people, not just simply thinking of Black liberation as the resurrection and restoration of Black male power, but the embrace of the fullness of our Black humanity, the fullness of our Black power, the fullness of our Black beauty. And I just simply think that that work is what Jesus was getting at in John 10:10, when Jesus says, "I've come that they might have life."
Abundance. Yes.
All Kiese doing is doing what Jesus said. He's just putting Blackness to it. It's Black abundance. That's the gospel. That's a critical part of understanding the good news of Jesus for Black folk. Black abundance. And I truly believe, as the old theologian would say, I think it was Irenaeus, he says, the glory of God is human beings fully alive. And I put a spin on it that I think the glory of God is Black people alive. And I think that's where my faith lies and what I'm trying to accomplish and what I'm trying to embody.
Amen. So now I'm going to have a little speed round and a little game for you, and then we're going to call it a day, because we can go round and round on this. Yeah. What is your favorite book?
Oh, dang, that's a good question. What is my favorite book? Oh, my goodness. Wow. I'm going to go based on like what book has probably like shaped me the most and I wrote in the most and probably given away the most. No lie, it's probably Heavy by Kiese. It helped me make sense of so many other areas in my life. And it made me a better writer. It made me a better man. It made me a better preacher. It made me a better minister. It made me a better person. So yeah. Heavy by Kiese.
Who was your favorite author?
Who's my favorite author? I think Tony K. Bambara. I ain't gonna lie. I think Tony K. I love Baldwin. I really love James Baldwin. Like, James Baldwin's out there for me. But there's something like about Tony K. that I really, 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 really love. And I think Tony K is probably my favorite.
What brings you joy?
Being around my wife and my family and my kids, and just getting up every day, waking up and seeing them, getting my kids ready and taking my son to daycare and, you know, getting and feeding my baby girl. I love my family. I got some beautiful kids. I have a beautiful, beautiful wife. And yeah, that's probably what bring me joy every single day beyond everything.
And what brings you peace?
Headspace and my anxiety medication. So yeah, that probably bring me, that's the most peaceful.
All right. My little game is called Rewriting the Classics. So what's the one book you wish you would have written?
Oh, if I could write any book and my name be on it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, dang. probably Just Above My Head by Baldwin.
Okay.
I think. But I don't know if people would consider Just Above My Head a classic. So
I'll say it was a classic.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's say Fire Next Time. You know, Fire Next Time. Let's just say Fire Next Time.
Okay. what's one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
Nella Larson's Passing. I probably would change the ending and giving it a little bit more. Give me a little bit more, because years have passed, you know, and whoever that is looks up You know, I make the case that there was like a religious imagery to it, of her being in hell looking up or whatnot. If you think about it in that kind of, you know, religious context connotation, like give a little bit more. I probably change like the imagery of passing.
And then name a book that you think is overrated and why.
Oh, that's hard. Cause like, dang, that's hard. That's going to get me in trouble. Is this like a classic or like
anything? Anything that you think is overrated?
That's okay. All right. I'ma just generalize this. I think Christian writing in general is overrated. And I think we as Christians can be much better writers. And I would rewrite it by encourage Christian writers, you know, I won't name like books, but I can name them off the top of my head. I ain't gonna name no books, but like, I feel like a lot of it is like dishonest writing in the sense of like, it just does not tell the truth about our own stories and about our own faith and about our own history. So yeah, I would rewrite a whole lot of Christian literature. Yeah.
All right. You avoided being messy.
I ain't gonna be messy. I'm not gonna be messy. I ain't gonna do it. I ain't gonna get in trouble.
So two more questions for you. You've got Shouting in the Fire, an American epistle. What's next for you in terms of your writing? What do you want to do next?
Well, I got like two projects in the works. I think my next joint I want to do is like my next book project is a collection of essays. I already kind of mapped it out. Like I mapped it. Like it's basically technically the book. I just haven't written, you know, the book yet, but I've outlined it. I got a name that I love. So I want to do that. But then like also, no lie, I got this little fiction book I want to write too. So like I'm always challenging myself as a writer. So like I'd be writing like little short stories in my own time. And so I want to write like a collection of short stories too.
Okay.
Like particularly short stories around like a young Black dude that's just like me that grew up in the rural South and like in the Black rural religious South. I want to write like his story or whatnot.
So like the secret lives of church boys.
hey, for real. Hey, you know what? Hey, I hope Deja hear this. I'm texting Deja right now. And tell Deja I'm writing a Secret Lives of Church Boys.
Tell I said what's up. All right, my final question for the podcast. When you are dead and gone among the ancestors and standing at the pearly gates, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of work and words that you left behind?
Wow. I've really been thinking about this question, especially on September 2nd. One of my best friends, dear friends, mentor, died tragically in a motorcycle accident. And sending love to his family, the Pattons, and just holding up his memory, David Patton. That's a blessing. So I've been really thinking about ever since I got the text sitting at my bed. It was 4 o'clock in the morning when I received the text. And I've been thinking so much about this question. When I'm done, when I'm complete, I think what I want people to say is that like he grew old, however old I am, you know, and he learned how to grow up. And he was a dude who really was healed and whole. He didn't die in pain. And so he died free and he lived free. And so I think when somebody eulogized me, I want them to be able to, you know, say that you know, he lived and he died free. He lived and he died whole. He made some mistakes, but he learned and he became a different person in the process.
Amen. Thank you, Dante.
For sure.
Big thank you to Dante Stewart for being here on Black and Published today. Make sure you check out Dante's debut memoir, Shouting in the Fire, an American Epistle. It's out now from Convergent, an imprint of Random House. And if you're not following Dante, follow him on the socials. He's at StewartDanteC on Instagram and Twitter. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Dante about the influences that gave him the courage to write his book and the impact reading The Color Purple had on his own literary offering. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week. Peace.